From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for May 6, 2022. Your defending NBA champs, the Milwaukee Bucks, are home Saturday and Monday with the Celtics. The Brewers are on the road this entire week with Atlanta and Cincinnati, and Saturday it's the 148th running of the Kentucky Derby. Oh, and one more thing. Today is National No Pants Day. Thankfully, we don't have any celebrants in the studio. A woman in London married her cat. Don't get ahead of me here. The flat she lives in has a no pet policy, so she came up with a workaround. She married Mr. Jinx the Fourth, reasoning they couldn't evict her and the cat because he's not a pet, he's her husband. If she wins this case, you just know there'll be 20 cats living in that apartment by the year's end. Keeping with strange marriage theme, a man in Japan married a hologram, but he can't talk to his hologram wife because of a software glitch. I know guys that would kill for that. This month is No Mow May. If you don't cut your grass in May, you're helping the pollinators like bees to survive. This means you can do your civic duty by lying in your hammock in knee-deep grass with a beer in your hand for the entire month. And it's guilt-free. And finally, this is just the kind of story every 8-year-old boy loves. Emissions from cows can be seen from outer space. And don't make me repeat that. The gas cloud from a California feedlot can be seen from space with high-resolution satellites. The upside to these emissions, if captured, they could power 15,000 homes for a year. And the downside? There's probably not enough air freshener on the planet. On the podcast today, oh, by the way, they're all wearing pants. We have Steve Giles, Chris Evers, Joel Dreesang, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. Rough week overall for the NASDAQ, down 1.5%, closing today at 12,145. But despite a considerable amount of volatility this week, the S&P and Dow closed largely unchanged, down just 0.2% for each. The Dow losing 76 points this week to close at 32,901, again down 0.2%. The S&P down 8 points only this week, closing at 41,24. Again, down 0.2%. For the year, the NASDAQ now down 22.2%, the S&P down 13.1%, and the Dow down 8.9%. The yield on the benchmark U.S. 10-year Treasury moving significantly higher this week, up from 2.89 to 3.12, in part perhaps on some news that the Fed had on Wednesday. And maybe that's a good place to start, Steve, as we look at just how significantly markets jumped around this week. We had a near 1,000-point day for the Dow on Wednesday, another near 1,000-point day in the wrong direction for the Dow on Thursday, largely in response to what the Fed had to say, I think, about rates, largely in response to investors just continuing to focus almost exclusively on what's a small number of problems and very, I think, short-term in nature in terms of Fed action, which, you know, certainly could carry over for a little while, but longer term tend to, you know, I think coincide with directions of the business cycle, and then, you know, some news on war in Ukraine.
Yeah, certainly a very interesting week, Kyle, and with everybody as hyper-focused on the Fed as they are, the news on Wednesday that Powell was going to raise rates by 0.5% was certainly expected. And what led to that market rally was his verbiage that they probably would not need to be as aggressive with their July rate hikes. And instead of going 0.75%, he hinted that maybe they would only do 0.5%. And as we all know, if the Fed is not going to be as hawkish with their rate increases, the market certainly rallied on the coattails of that. Everybody woke up on Thursday, though, and realized that if the Fed's not going to be that hawkish with respect to rising interest rates, inflation might stick around a little longer than people were expecting, and we gave back everything and then some on Thursday, only to limp through the end of the week here today on Friday.
It is incredible to me just how much bouncing around there was to get back to, again, 8 points for the S&P. Not much, I think, in the, you know, kind of in the broader context to write home about for the week. But certainly as you digest some of what the Fed talked about, rolling off potentially $1 trillion a year from the balance sheet over the next 3 years. Keep in mind the Fed's balance sheet stands at around $9 trillion right now, so they've got a lot of work to do there. But I think as importantly, you know, Jay Powell mentioned that the balance sheet roll-off that I think some people were concerned about the last time around, maybe not the piece that is the primary mechanism they'll be using to fight inflation. So, you know, I think the Fed continues to be the piece that's in focus. Chris, we look at earnings this week. You know, we're getting 80%+ of the way through first quarter earnings season. We're significantly ahead of where we thought we'd be, whether it's, you know, when we started the first quarter or whether it's when we ended. We thought maybe 6.5%, 7% earnings growth, shaping up to be 10. So how do you reconcile kind of the earnings picture that continues to look okay with, you know, maybe the Fed picture that continues to add to the volatility?
Yeah, Kyle, I'll note a couple things here on the earnings front. So the first part is earnings have been strong this year for a few reasons. One being energy earnings have really picked up this year because of oil prices coming up. I don't think that was necessarily put into the calculation by a lot of, you know, economists that were looking forward into 2022 earnings, was saying, oh, there's going to be a big host of profits from energy companies this year because prices would continue to rise at the rate that they have. The second part is, inflation has helped a little bit on the top line for some businesses, and they've been able to generate profits as a result of that. We've talked a lot about how, you know, earnings have been strong, but interest rates have come up. And what that has done is made the market more attractive from a valuation standpoint. So what we've really seen is just valuation on the markets come down. And what we mean by that, again, is that price to earnings ratio. So the price of the market divided by its earnings level. Earnings has remained strong, but price has come down a little bit. Gives us a little bit more attractive price to earnings ratio going forward.
Steve, you've always been one of the biggest champions for balanced portfolios as we sit around the table, you know, doing the podcast week to week. You know, I think the biggest challenge we have faced this year is that the piece that normally holds up when stocks are down, the bond piece, has not been as encouraging, I think, for investors as we typically expect. Chris, you looked at some data that kind of puts that in context in terms of the balanced portfolio. But both of you, I wonder kind of how this all fits into kind of the broader outlook for balanced portfolios.
Yeah, I'll jump in first because we were just, you know, talking around the table here before, and I came in with a stat of what were the five worst years for a 60-40 balanced portfolio over the last 100. You know, and some of them you could think off the top of your head, all right, that was going to be Great Recession, sure, down 17% for a balanced portfolio. And then going back to the Depression, we had 1931 down 31%. 1937 down 22, and 1974 down 15. And then the last one, the fifth that I'll mention, is so far year to date this first quarter, because which is down about 13% for a 60-40, which has mostly been on the back of the surprising decline in values of bond portfolios, because we've seen a what I'll call a once in a generation move in interest rates in such a short period of time. You know, we see stock prices fall back 15 to 20%. You know, every 12 to 18 months, that, you know, that's not anything shocking on the stock side of the portfolio. But when we see bonds give up that much value in that short of a time period, that's what really has moved the calculus for this year.
And Chris, I think the operative word in your comments is value. You're not losing money on your bonds. You've just seen a decline in its current value. Bonds always move in inverse to Fed rate changes. If rates go up, your values go down. But unless you sell that bond, unless the fund managers that are holding those bonds within your bond mutual funds, you're not going to lose any money. All those bonds are going to come due, and eventually you'll be made whole on your investments. And at the same time, when that money does come due, those fund managers are going to be taking that cash and putting it right back into work. Into all of these now higher yielding investment income products, because the Fed has been raising rates across the board.
Well, I think you need only look at the Treasury or CD market right now to get just an understanding of exactly what you're saying. You can get a 2 or 3 year Treasury right now paying north of 2.6, 2.7. You can get a CD that's paying about the same. And so, you know, for investors who have been looking for places to park money, it's been a difficult road the last decade because you just didn't get paid to do it. And granted, in the current environment with high inflation, maybe the real rate of return isn't all that attractive. But if inflation does come back down and you've locked in that 2.5 or 3 over the next couple of years, you know, I think all of a sudden interest rates start to look a little more attractive.
I do find it interesting, Kyle, that I've already gotten offers, two different offers in the last 2 months from the same lender, recommending that I give them a deposit. The first one was a pretty nice yield compared to zero. The second one was even higher still. And I think if investors are patient enough, we're going to start to see those fixed income products at banks and savings accounts and our credit unions get a little bit more attractive.
And Steve, you used my favorite word earlier, value, in looking at potentially some opportunity in bonds. I think, you know, the opposite of that is there's also some opportunity in stocks right now as we look at the forward PE on the S&P 500 now down around 17.5%. As you know, and as we've pointed out over the years in the seminar, that equates to an earnings yield for the S&P 500 of about 5.7% right now, which again, as I mentioned in the open, the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury is a little north of 3.1. Okay, so you put $100 in a Treasury and you get 3.1% or 3 cents on the dollar invested. You put that same amount of money in the stock market right now, you're getting nearly double that in terms of earnings on your money there. And so I think an interesting story is unfolding about how bonds are becoming a more valuable option at the exact same time that stocks may be becoming more valuable as well.
Yeah, before this, you know, we were talking and I mentioned that Jason Zweig had come out with an article that'll probably be, I think, in this weekend's edition of the Wall Street Journal, talking about the bond market and how, you know, essentially the way he'll, you know, describe it and the way that I've been talking to clients about it is it's short-term pain for long-term gain, right? So we've seen bond prices come down, which means now that future-looking interest rates that you're going to get on these bond portfolios are much more attractive. But you're seeing investors pull money from bonds, right? So you're seeing investors look at the price declines that they've had recently and take cash out, even though, frankly, if you look at the opportunity set going forward, you know, new money's in or just from this point forward, because that's what we always have to do, right? What does it look like going forward? What's my risk-reward profile? The risk-reward profile looking forward is much more attractive than it's been for, you know, dare I say a decade in fixed income markets based on the new, you know, interest rates that are out there.
That gets back to Steve's word, patience.
Mm-hmm. Joel, some maybe patient economic data this week, or economic data about patience in some cases,
yeah.
I think. Anything in particular jump out to you?
You know, we had a whole bunch of stuff come out this week, and a lot of it was just, I mean, you know, some very positive things. We, you know, the ISM, Institute for Supply Management, came out with its manufacturing index and its service sector index. Both of them have been expanding. Both of those sectors have been expanding for 23 months in a row. Factory orders came out. They've been up for 22 out of the last 23 months. Construction spending led by residential spending at a record high. We had a couple of things that didn't necessarily look good in the headlines, but if you look past it, if you have some patience, they're probably okay. Worker productivity, we actually declined in productivity. It was, depending upon if you look at the annual rate, it was 1947 since it's been that bad. It sunk 7.5% in the first quarter, change from the fourth quarter. If you look at it, which is a more realistic way, probably year to year, it fell 0.6%, which isn't as big, but that's also the biggest decline since 1993. Both of those, you can sort of discount a little because there's a lot of volatility in productivity numbers, and especially now, especially in the last 2 years, all that's been going on in the economy with the pandemic, and now with supply chain problems, and so that's something that'll work out over time. If you look at the longer term, you know, productivity is up since before the pandemic. So if you just think of it this way, GDP exceeded what it was before the pandemic mid-year in 2021, and we still don't have the same number of jobs that we had when the pandemic began. So we've recovered as far as productivity, but the number of workers still isn't out there. So that's a way to look at it.
And of course, the math on GDP growth is simply your growth of your workforce plus your productivity growth. It'll tell you how fast GDP should be growing. And so if you're not growing your workforce, and that's a challenging thing for our country and our economy to continue to grow the workforce when so many employees are aging out of the workforce, well, the other way you do that is to grow productivity. And so I think it's an indicator that we watch fairly closely, although if you watch it too closely, you get caught up in some of the volatility.
Right.
That we're seeing
you don't watch it too closely in too short of bursts of time. The other thing, so we had a GDP report last week that surprised a lot of people by saying that GDP actually declined. And part of that, a big part of that, was the trade gap. So we had news this week on the trade gap, and it's at a record, a record level. And a lot of that is, some of that is due to the fact that the U.S. is recovering a lot stronger from the pandemic than our trading partners. So that gap, has grown. But if we look at it over a longer time, that might straighten out. But that detracts from the GDP number.
And some data in the labor market this week that points to some wage pressure.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like looking at the labor numbers. We had a couple of things. So look at it this way. So on Tuesday, the Labor Department reported that we had a record number of job openings. 11.5 million jobs were open in March. So today we got numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics saying that we had, remember that number, 11.5 million. So we have 5.9 million who are unemployed and in the last 4 weeks were looking for a job. So they're active job seekers. We also have 5.9 million who want to work, but in the last 4 weeks haven't been looking for jobs. And like 1 out of 10 of those is because they say that COVID is a factor, whether they can't find the people to take care of people that they need, or that they have health concerns, or maybe they're in an industry that's still hurt by COVID. So that's 11.8 million people still wanting to work and 11.5 million job openings. So that's making that situation look a little bit better. But because we don't have those 11.8 million in the workforce, there's a premium on workers. So the numbers today showed that the average wage in the U.S. went up by 5.5% from a year ago. But that compares with 5.6% in March. So it's actually down a little bit. So that's one of those levels of inflation that you have to watch because, once you pay somebody more money, it's hard to take that back.
Yeah, usually people aren't too happy about continuing to do the same work for less money. That's a fair point.
I've been in that position before, so I know that not too happy.
I think the other one, that was released this afternoon, which is one that Chris has really championed the past couple of weeks, is this consumer credit number, pointing, I think, to a consumer that is not necessarily all that pessimistic about the future.
Yeah, there are different ways to look at this, and I'm ready to have Chris chime in on this. But the Fed reported today that revolving consumer credit, or mostly credit cards, that the outstanding debt for that is actually went up by 35% on an annualized basis in March. And so now that level of credit card debt is just 0.3% away from where it was before the pandemic. And one of the things that I point out on this is that during the financial crisis, it took a decade to get back to where we were with consumer credit debt.
Yeah, and the point that I'd been making when we were talking about this a little bit earlier, Joel, was, you know, a thought process that I've been going through really for the last 2 years is looking at consumer savings rates and what happened to credit card spending. And over the last 2 years, you saw a massive increase in consumer savings and a huge drop in consumer credit card debt, which showed a lot of people with all the excess money they saved, either by not spending it or from stimulus or what have you, use it to pay down credit card debt and kind of clean up their financial house, which was great, right? That really set us on the footing that allowed us to have this really, really strong returns to spending in late 2020 and early 2021. But the recent climb in credit card debt, I read into it as consumers maybe are spending through some of that excess cash and now are returning to having to put some of that on credit cards. You know, we've talked about the dichotomy of thrift or the paradox of thrift of, yeah, you want somebody to save, but it means a bad thing for the economy, so you don't ever want everybody to save. I think there's also a true side of this to, well, you want people to spend money, but you don't necessarily want to do it all on credit card debt because that's kind of borrowing from tomorrow for today's savings or for today's spending. So I'm looking at it from a perspective of, well, you know, the consumer might be burning through some of that excess cash that they saved up over the last 2 years.
Again, it's something we have to watch over a longer period. I mean, mm-hmm. if they're getting 5.5% raises and the inflation rate does go down, they're still going to have that 5.5% raise, and maybe that's going to help pay off that debt and keep them spending.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think despite all the volatility we saw this week, I think the reality is, you look at the numbers, echoes much of what I'm hearing as we talk through this all, is that not much has changed. We're still focused on the Fed. We're still talking about inflation. We're still looking at what the impacts of those will be as we get into the second half of this year and beyond. And so, you know, it's no surprise that the market hears something it likes and it takes a big pop. It starts to digest that and realize maybe it wasn't as great as they thought, and it sells off the other way. And so I think, if anything, it's just a function of, much like the Fed, continuing to be dependent on the data, continuing to kind of get an understanding for what the outlook is and lean into the opportunities that are out there. Well, thank you, as always, for listening. We enjoy doing the program, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.